Okay, I'm going to call to order and to alertness this this February 9th hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education. Welcome, everyone. We have some very interesting topics to bring before you today. The first having to do with workforce, the second having to do with forestry education at our universities. We also have some amendments to introduce on House Bill 4057, the ratio reporting bill. But why don't we start off with House Bill 4141. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4141. Let me tell you a little bit about this bill, which you have before you in the dash one format. The dash ones are a gut and stuff that, so if you look at the dash ones, you will see the bill. It will make sense to you. I will say initially that the drafting on this was not perfect, and so we will have to get a dash two on this, but it's close, and I can explain the intent. And so let me just present the bill. I'm the sponsor of this, the chief sponsor of this bill, and it has to do with Oregon's various workforce development streams and a desire to bring them into greater alignment, to make them more transparent, and to give us all a better sense of just what's going on in this state in terms of workforce development. What are we doing? How are we investing our dollars? And what are we getting from those dollars? I would draw your attention to the beginning of the bill, which has a series of whereases, which I'm just going to go over with you as the sort of background to this, the problem that we're trying to solve with this bill, and then we'll have panels to talk about just how workforce development works in this state and how it could work better. So if you look at the beginning of the bill, whereas Oregon, like the rest of the nation, is facing reductions in federal and state workforce programs, and whereas our current workforce system and economic development initiatives could be better aligned and leveraged to deliver a workforce that meets business needs for skilled workers, and whereas Oregonians could benefit from a more highly aligned and integrated workforce system, and whereas the Legislative Assembly and the public need a clear and global understanding of the various workforce funding streams and the deployment and outcome of those investments, and whereas Oregon has embarked on an effort to better target public investments in order to improve public services, narrow the state's wage gap, increase employment, and end our, quote, cycle of scarcity, and whereas the State Workforce Investment Board is currently engaged in a strategic planning process to create a set of strategies to guide the entire workforce system, and whereas Oregon requires a further effort that looks at our entire workforce system, breaks down silos, clarifies vision and outcomes, and focuses on proven strategies for better results. Now, therefore, and the bill follows. And what the bill calls for is a process that is co-led by the governor's office and our Oregon Workforce Investment Board. You know, this state has a workforce investment board that includes representatives from industry, from labor, from a number of different groups, some legislators. I'm one of the two House representatives on it. Representative Huffman is my partner from the House. Senator Rosenbaum from the Senate and Senator George from the Senate. We're the four legislators on it. Does very important work. It's, as the bill indicates, it's in the middle of some high-level strategic planning. And now we want to look to the next steps. The bill talks about having the Workforce Investment Board prepare legislation to the body. That's one of the things that needs to be changed in the bill. it's not clear what, if any, legislation will have to be developed. It may be that this can be handled through other kinds of initiatives, through requests for federal waivers in some cases, legislation may be a part of that, but it's all to achieve the aims that you will see here in Section B of the bill. So that's sort of the background. I mean, I think the basic need here is, if I were to ask you, I asked this question in our caucus meeting last week that, you know, some of you were privileged to be part of, and others, you know, maybe someday you'll get there. But no, just, that's a joke. If I were to ask you how much money comes into this state from the federal government, and that's where most of it comes from, for workforce development, who could tell me that? I suspect that nobody on this dais could. If I were to ask you just how that money is being distributed locally, statewide, we know some of it goes to community colleges, some of it may be going to programs that are partnerships with labor apprenticeship programs. Some of it is going through State Employment Division. But probably nobody in this dais could really answer that question. It may be that nobody in this state at this point could easily answer that question, and that's something that has to change. And along with that, the further question of what exactly are we getting from this? What jobs are coming into the state because we have the skilled workforce to support those jobs? Which workers are able to upgrade their skills and move into new jobs? Those are all questions that I believe need to be answered, particularly in a time of declining resources, stressed resources. So, yes, Rep. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, just to piggyback on your questions and your line of thought there, but I wonder if we could also posit the question of how many jobs could come into this state if, in fact, we believe in natural resource development, which is actually bill number 2 today. So there is a tie in there. So thank you for teeing that up.
This is a very thematically driven committee. Thank you, Rep. Johnson. Okay, so with that, I'm going to call up the first panel. We have Agnes Balassa, who's the governor's workforce policy advisor, Greg White, who's the executive of the Workforce Investment Board, and Kim Parker. Is Kim here or by phone?
She's here.
Okay, great. Oh, yeah. And then we also will have Rosie Pryor and Janice Chandler by phone. And they're both with us?
Yes.
Hi, welcome, both of you. So we're going to start with Agnes. Agnes, would you introduce yourself and give us some background, please?
Co-Chair Denbrough and Co-Chair Johnson's members of the committee, I'm Agnes Balassa. I am the governor's workforce policy advisor as of January 1st. I know I can't use that line for very much longer, but I'm 1 month in and very glad to be here in front of you today. In terms of the conversation here today, it's one that's very near and dear to my heart because it's part of the reason that I was brought in as a workforce policy advisor was to take a look at this system and to take a look at the opportunities for us to find greater alignment, greater results, better services. For those of you that I've met before, I've been in front of a number of panels over the years. I have a long history in the workforce development system, and I'm passionate about assuring that we provide the best service to our Oregonians who need help figuring out what their career goals are, as well as those who need help moving forward with their careers, as well as for our businesses. We need a highly skilled workforce so that our businesses are competitive nationally and internationally, and I believe that the skills that we can help people gain are critical to our competitiveness. When we talk to companies, one of the first things they always say that is critical to their success is a highly skilled workforce. So I come at this from both sides and have worked programs on both sides, both publicly funded ones as well as privately supported ones. I want to start off by saying that I have a strong belief that we can't really continue to do business as we have in many of our public systems. We have a number of challenges that have been growing over the last years and have probably reached crisis points as our resources have really dwindled and made it hard for us to be able to carry on business as usual, where sometimes in the past we may have had the resource to carry on a practice just because we had enough resource to continue to do work that way. In Oregon's case, the workforce system consists of about 26 federal programs, and we can debate the actual number because not all of these programs are strictly labeled as workforce programs. These are programs that have workforce somewhere in their mission. And so depending on how we slice or dice it, it may be 23, it may be 27, but the reality is that they're federally and state-funded programs, and so we look at them as a very loosely organized system at this point because all of these programs have one thing in common, that somewhere in their mission, they are working to get people back to work or into better jobs. The system is overseen at the state level by an Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is a private sector-led body. As Representative Denbrough mentioned, the body has representation from not only private industry, but organized labor, legislature, publicly funded programs, and a variety of others in order to assure that we have a nonpartisan, non-biased organization always looking at the system and making recommendations for improvement. At the state level, we also have a workforce policy cabinet, which is charged with the operationalization of these workforce programs. And at the local level, we have local workforce boards who are charged with the alignment of programs and with the operationalization of a number of services, some of which are run by state agencies, some of which are run at the local level by local boards. So it's a complicated system. The services are delivered through a series of WorkSource centers where people who are seeking jobs can go to get better jobs. But there's also a vast array of other services and other service locations that are part of the network that create the whole system. So you have Department of Human Services sites, you have community college sites, you have apprenticeship sites, you have a variety of other approaches to workforce development that are all part of the network that make up this system. And traditionally, at least since I've been in this system, I've been working with it since about 1996 here in Oregon, we have had a commitment to systems alignment. So the commitment has always been there. If you look at a piece of legislation that was passed right here in this building back in the late 1990s, early 2000, the intent is clearly spelled out that we have a highly aligned and coordinated workforce system. The challenge is that over the years, the system has continued to become fragmented as resources have dwindled, as program mandates have changed, as the economy has changed, and the needs of the people that we serve have changed. Federal agencies have shifted their focuses, sometimes drawing partners apart. As resources have shifted, organizations have looked inward to figure out how they can continue to serve their client base, making it difficult to have the resources to partner across systems. As the economy has changed, what we know is that some of the things that we did in past recessions are not likely to apply in this one. The fact that we're in a recovery but without jobs is a totally new kind of thing for us. The fact that we have hundreds of thousands of people on the bench who have skills, in some cases very, very good skills, and still can't get reconnected to work easily because jobs are being created so slowly. All of those things imply different ways for us to work with the clients that we have in front of us and to support the industries of this state. And the fact is that 70% of the workforce of 2025 is already or has recently been engaged in the workforce, which means traditional approaches to education don't always work for them because they are working learners. They are people who are trying to better themselves and their opportunities while still trying to do everything they can to keep their families afloat. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. I also want to say that while we're clear that we have these challenges, Oregon is also nationally recognized for some of the innovations that we've done over the last several years. We are nationally recognized as a leader in career pathways, a program that shortens the timeline for adults to be able to move up in careers. We are nationally recognized for the fact that we are extending those pathways to lower-skilled adults. We have undertaken in the last 3 years a systems integration effort to better align services in the WorkSource centers so that anyone who comes through WorkSource has their skills assessed and has the opportunity to try to improve their skills. We have adopted a national career readiness certificate, and in fact, based on legislation also, that was also a legislative directive, to certify the skills of Oregonians and to give them a portable credential so that should they lose their jobs, they have something they can take with them to prove that they have certain skills and the abilities to learn on the job and to succeed. We've paired that with some other programs to create a Back to Work Oregon program to try to target those that have fairly good skills but are having difficulty getting into the labor market because they're not translating as well as they need to. So we have a number of strong things that we can build off of and a number of innovations that I think serve us well. We're looking at expanding some of those into a work-ready communities pilot. But the challenge is that these are still things that we're doing largely around the margins as opposed to the core of the system. And I think that's the piece when you talk about transparency and budgeting and how we align and integrate programs. I think that's where we have some work to do to make sure that as these investments come to scale, or we have the opportunity to bring some of these investments to scale while still maintaining those core sets of services that we need for the general population. The work that's described in House Bill 4141 aligns very well with the work that I've agreed to take on in my role as the governor's workforce policy advisor. As Representative Dembro stated, we did have some concerns about the language about coming back with legislation because we don't know how much of what inhibits us from doing this right now is just practice and how much of it is interpretation of existing regulations. And so over the next year, as we go through a process of completing a unified planning project, which Greg will talk about, a strategic plan, and starting to create implementation plans, we will be taking a look at what needs to be changed, what barriers need to be removed in order to be able to create greater transparency alignment, and where necessary, integration as well. We're just not sure yet what the end result of that will be and whether it will result in legislative proposals. We do welcome the partnership of the legislature in supporting this set of goals and activities that I believe are also very, very important for our system. It's just that one piece, we're not sure exactly where we would end up on that, and I'd hate to promise something I couldn't bring back to you all. What I'd really like to do, just as that general framing, is to hand it over to some of the folks who would like to speak more specifically about the system. I'm going to ask Greg White to talk about the strategic planning process that OWIB is undertaking, and we'll follow that process so you have a better understanding of where that's going. And then I think we'll go to Rosie Pryor on the phone, who is the OWIB chair. She's the private sector chair of the board. I'll introduce her after Greg completes his piece, if that works. Thank you,
Agnes. Greg?
Good afternoon, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg White. I'm executive staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which has been greatly, just fine, described by Agnes and by co-chair Dembro. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here today. My role on this panel is to describe briefly, and I hope it's brief, the strategic planning effort currently underway by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. We've been at it for 11 months now, and I'll explain why it's taking so long. This effort builds on the work we've done over the last 3 years, and as Agnes described, much has been accomplished already. The OWIB, the Governor's Office, the Workforce Policy Cabinet, local workforce investment boards, and numerous other stakeholders have been participating fully in this effort, and which it does include greater alignment and accountability, as is called for in this bill. And I'd like to echo Agnes's gratitude for the legislature's intentions and support and for these efforts that we're undertaking. First of all, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board produced Winning in the Global Market, our strategic plan, current strategic plan, a little over 5 years ago. Many of you have seen it. I think almost all the members of the legislature received a copy of it, and it's widely available. And it was really good for its time. It changed people's thinking. It changed people's thinking about, let's build a demand-driven workforce that meets the demand of business and isn't dependent on the training programs that are currently available in the provider system. This plan kind of got people thinking about a high-wage, high-demand jobs system. And for that, I think we had great successes with that. It got all the workforce partners on the same page and got us really marching forward in the, to do a lot of coordination. And as resources have diminished, the imperative to do even more of that has risen in people's consciousness. But full implementation of this plan was really difficult. There are over 20 separate initiatives and result areas in the plan, many of them not adequately resourced. So it was really impossible almost for the providers and the state agencies and the local agencies and everyone in the system to actually implement completely. It also didn't have a way to update the plan, which doesn't make much sense considering that in the middle of that five-year period we had the greatest downturn in the economy since the Great Depression. And it has rather diffuse accountability for system results, not for individual program results. All the individual programs have their own set of performance measures that have been met just fine. But for system results, there is little accountability. So we undertook a strategic planning effort, and this strategic planning effort basically had two phases. The first phase was to check to see how we're doing. Has this plan been effective? How could it be improved? We hired out to a consulting team to do this work for us, very closely followed and led by the Governor's Office, the Workforce Policy Cabinet, and myself and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And came up with a lot of good, there was a report card, and there are recommendations going forward that were pretty specific. To echo something that Agnes alluded to, when our consultants went out and asked national groups, what is the best state strategic plan for workforce that you know of? They just kind of laughed and said, we thought it was Oregon. And there really are only 6 or 8 states that actually have strategic plans like this, separate from the program plans that are necessary to go to the federal government, for example, to get the resources into the state. So we are a leading state in many ways, and this is actually reinforcing our leadership to undertake this. The recommendations that came out of that process, I'll go over them very quickly, paraphrased. Clarify the leadership and governance, create a framework that can be adopted statewide, enhance connections with education and economic development, partner with all stakeholder organizations, create a communication structure for coordinating and continuous improvement, streamline the number of initiatives in the plan and reduce the number of key result areas, create a process for updating the plan, and create a detailed implementation plan. And if this starts sounding familiar, it's because much what's in the bill before you today are those very things. Then phase two, and that's where we are today, was to actually update the plan. We found out what we would like to update, and so we move forward to update it. The Oregon Workforce Investment Board has worked on the vision. Local workforce investment boards will convene locally and come up with their own strategic plans, which will roll up to vision goals and objectives in the state plan. That plan, that high-level strategic plan, will be done somewhere around the end of June or during June. Then, of course, the hard work begins, because then we will have to develop implementation plans, both at the state level and at the local level. These will be highly detailed. We have resisted in many ways people's desire to move forward to the implementation and said, no, we need to know where we're going first. So that's what we'll be doing then, beginning in the summer, and we expect that work to be done at the very latest, the end of the calendar year. The goals of the planning, looking at it in kind of an overall or big picture sense, are very remarkably similar to this bill. Alignment of resources, federal, state, and local, clear accountability for results, coordinating among all partners, system metrics and regular reporting of them, more transparent budgeting and funding, and enhanced responsiveness of workforce programs to community needs. So I'm going to end there, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to take them. Thank you very much.
Why don't we move on, unless anybody has a specific question?
I'll come back after our next panel.
Okay, great.
Panelist, I guess.
Yes. Okay, Kim,
actually,
thank
the,
you.
The next one is,
I think Rosie.
Oh, Rosie, that's right, I'm sorry.
It's a different topic.
Yeah. Rosie, hi, this is Representative Dembro.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. It's great to hear you. So have you been listening? So you heard what Greg just said?
I have been listening. Are you able to hear me okay?
Oh, yes. In fact,
okay, that's great. That's great. Well, Chair Dembro, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today, particularly for the courtesy of permitting me to do it by telephone. My name is Rosie Pryor. I am the Chief Marketing and Strategic Planning Officer for Oregon Community Credit Union based in Lane County. And I'm also a member of the Lane Workforce Partnership Board for the past 8 years, and for the past year, a member of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and just recently I became chair of the board. Just incidentally, I'm also a member of the Lane Community College Board of Education. So workforce is something that I have a passion for, and I'm particularly really, really pleased to have the opportunity to tell you that philosophically I am so grateful for the support that is the intent of this piece of legislation before you. My greatest concern as a member of a regional board and now a member of the state workforce board is to seize the opportunity that appears to me to be before us now, with a willingness on your part and on the part of our governor to look at things differently, to think outside of the traditional paradigm, and to help us align the component parts that we have in Oregon of a really excellent delivery system to help people get back to work and to get involved in better jobs. I've been involved in working on the update of this strategic plan for the last year, as the chair of the OWIB Strategic Planning Committee, and I can tell you we are determined to deliver on a plan that will align the component parts of Oregon's workforce and training system and help us take what's already outstanding results to an even greater level. This strategic plan has the potential to help us coordinate better among workforce services and service delivery organizations, to connect the workforce services better to education and economic development, a particular interest of mine. Alignment can't be spoken to too often, and efficiency is certainly something that resonates with me as a business person. But one thing this strategic plan will also do, it will enhance coordination between the state and local workforce delivery systems. And as a member of one of Oregon's seven regional workforce boards, I can tell you we have work we can do there to improve our track record and to do a better job. These are the very things that I shared with Governor Kitzhaber when he came to our meeting in December. And his response to me and to our board is that that's one of the reasons why he has created a workforce policy advisor position and hired Agnes Velasa. And I couldn't be more pleased to have Agnes in place because I think she's one of the most brilliant workforce operatives in Oregon, if not in the country. So we're very lucky to have her, and I think we're going to get some progress. So with that, let me stop, and if you have any questions for me, I would be honored to respond.
Thank you, Rosie. Why don't we hear from Janice, and then we'll open it up to questions. Oh, I'm sorry, to Kim first, and then Janice, and then we'll open it up to questions. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kim Parker. I am the Executive Director of the Workforce Investment Council, and we serve Workforce Region 15, which is comprised of Clackamas County. And I am looking at my notes here, and frankly, much of my talking points have been spoken to. Alignment is important. Coordination is important. Unlike Agnes, I'm relatively new to this world. I've been doing this for just about 3 years. And I think that really when it gets to the core of what it is I'm charged with doing, it's to get along well with others. So, you know, what did I learn in kindergarten? Get along well with others to serve the needs of our employers by providing them with a ready workforce so that we can recognize and achieve economic success. So when I come to the core of why I'm here, it's to serve employers and to serve job seekers. So what can I do to help make that happen? Well, I can make sure that we're working with each other. I can make sure that we do not have duplication. I can make sure that public resources are being spent in a responsible way so that those job seekers are able to get what they need to meet the needs of our employers. I think there's some other key words that I want to mention. That is simplify. We need to simplify this system. I think that this is being done a lot already on the ground, but by creating some intentionality, it will only help. It will improve that system. Accountability to multiple partners, I think, also will create a stronger, wiser system. And I want to take just a minute to tell you a little story that happened in our region in Clackamas County last year. I sat down, I was thinking about this the other day, I think it was probably just about a year ago, with my colleague at DHS, the DHS regional director. We met at Starbucks for a cup of coffee to chat, because that's kind of what we do once in a while. And he started talking to me about the TANF jobs program being cut. And we started doing some brainstorming about what's going to happen, because these are a lot of job seekers who have barriers to employment who would not be getting the same kinds of services that they had received before. And so we started thinking about working together better, because we frankly didn't do direct services together. And we rolled up our sleeves and let our staff loose. They sharpened their pencils. And on July 1st, we opened what we call the WorkSource Clackamas Annex. The investors in this annex include Workforce Investment Act through the Workforce Investment Board, so that's federal money. DHS, of course. There are veterans programs funded through federal dollars. Community Corrections is a partner that provides resources for this site. You walk into this site in Oregon City, and you do not know who is working for who. They're all working together, and their job is to serve job seekers with barriers to employment. So that could be being long-term unemployed. It could be a returning veteran. It could be somebody who's got a criminal history or a history with addiction. But it also, this whole experience also helped us reduce duplication. Through this process, we discovered that there was duplication, even in our single county. And it's been a terrific success. We're about 7 months into it, and I think that it's definitely going to continue. And I bring up this example because I'm confident there are these kinds of things happening throughout the state, but again, I'm not confident it's intentional. It might be a response to cuts, which is great. Don't want to take you don't want to miss an advantage of a crisis to make things better. But I do support the intentionality and the accountability that that this bill could bring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Kim, let me just make the point that we don't have Starbucks in every community in the state. So,
yeah, actually, a locally owned coffee shop would be just fine.
So this can be taken to scale, even if there's not a Starbucks.
I think we'd have to work on it, maybe do some research, but I think we could probably.
Thank you. Janice, welcome very much, Janice. And let me just say that I met Janice at the Oregon Business Plan Conference in Portland. There was a panel on workforce development that Agnes chaired there. Janice came to us and shared her experience as an HR manager. And I think she comes from the southern part of the state. Anyway, you'll introduce yourself, right?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate this opportunity.
Yes, and you will figure out very quickly that I'm not from Oregon, not even from Southern Oregon. But I do appreciate this opportunity to talk to you today about workforce and workforce investment and workforce development. I've been an HR manager for over 20 years, and primarily the entire time I've spent in manufacturing. And I started with workforce investment when it just on a board was created, when it changed over from CETA. So now you know how old I am, because all the folks in the room that know CETA, you all know how old we are. So anyway, it's been fascinating for me to listen to the conversations that have preceded me, because you understand, I think, very clearly, and I did in thinking about this, as a human resource manager, my job is among a lot of things, is to provide my company with the best possible human assets for each sector within my company, and for these assets to have all the skills necessary to do a superior job, and the flexibility to obtain skills to keep my company competitive in any market that it chooses or needs to impact. And that being said, along with the other stuff, you can understand by sitting in this room and listening to this prior conversation that it's difficult for the folks in this room and the folks in the agencies to understand this system. What kind of problems or difficulties can we possibly imagine for employers and job seekers to figure out this system or figure out how this works? It's just I know you've got to understand that it's mind-boggling, and that with all of the strategic initiatives that are great and that are ongoing, we do have to kind of remember that the customer at the very end is the job seeker and the job creator. And if we remember that all the way through this, I think we will get to a lot of good places. I've been using and am using currently the NCRC that Oregon has embraced, and I believe is going to be something that is going to be absolutely fabulous. And part of the NCRC.
And Janice, excuse me, the NCRC is the National Career Readiness Certificate, right?
That's correct.
Yes.
And the components that make up the NCRC, I've been using for the last 15 years, from the East Coast to the West Coast with employers very successfully, to assess workforce skills in a very, very broad sense. And it just works. It's one of those things that just works. It works on so many levels. It works for the employer. It works for the employee. It works for the new job seeker, the middle of their career job seeker. It works for every kind of job seeker, and it works for every employer, whether you're small, whether you've got 15 employees, or whether you have 1,500. It really doesn't make any difference. It works for each of those segments, which is one of the things that makes it so good. Also have been able in Oregon to take advantage of the OJT program as part of the Back to Work Oregon Back to Work program.
Janice, that's on the job training. Is that
OJT? That's on the job training. That's one of the things that manufacturers, I think, to a person will tell you, is one of the most difficult things for manufacturers to do is to train. Although you understand that a good although we get people through our education systems, K-12, higher education, the majority of employment skills are trained by employers because of the uniqueness or the speed of change or the amount of uniqueness within the company. The companies do a huge portion of training for our employees in the workforce. And as part of that, for an employer, and I believe over 75% of the employers in Oregon are what you would call mid to smaller employers, it becomes extremely difficult to provide training in a continuing basis, which is what you need to do. If you stop training, you stop continuous improvement, you stop being competitive in almost any market, then it's very difficult for the individual employer to do that without some additional resources like the OJT program. Because, for example, if a company like mine has 100 employees and I hire 10 employees, I made the point at the business summit, that would nearly cripple my company. Because not only do I have 10 new people, but I have 10 other people who have now been diverted from their productivity to train. So I've got 10% of my workforce now not able to produce. So that it becomes extremely problematic. And with manufacturing, one of the really big problems about training is actually pulling people off the floor to train. So one of the better solutions is to do OJT, which is on-the-job training, which is actually putting someone with a buddy person, a mentor, a trainer within their work area. So employers getting assistance with this through programs like the OJT program and the NCRC program, where they have a good understanding when the employee comes in, where their trainability is, where they are in a training matrix, where they can fit into training, and what training will be appropriate to them. I have to say that we put a lot of emphasis, and we need to and should, on education, but sometimes we don't put a lot of emphasis on learning. And employers are just as bad as the public sector. We've thrown training at employees for years. I mean, we buy big, pretty packages, and we just throw that training out there and say, here it is, now, learn. And we expect all of our employees to take that training in, and then we get really confused and upset and don't understand when they don't get it. But we do a very poor job of assessing our employees and assessing their training levels before we throw that training at them. So we don't even know if the training is appropriate. We don't know if our workforce is at the level that the training's at the level that they can take it in and be successful with it. So the NCRC is a really, really good tool to help work that out and to help give us a leg up on that. And then the OJT portion of the back to work program is also very helpful for the medium and small employer to help them meter in as they hire. And there are companies hiring. We do have jobs. But to meter in those folks instead of waiting to the very last second and then said, oh my goodness, I've got to have 10 people and they've got to be running at full speed tomorrow. And then you put those folks that you're hiring in a position to fail, and you put your company in a position to fail. So the OJT program has really helped us as an employer to meter in some employees for anticipated needs and get their training done ahead of time and not go into that DEFCON 5 mode of, you know, bring them in, put them on the floor, we've got to go now, we've got to run. No, we can actually bring some folks in a week or two, maybe even 3 weeks, maybe even 4 weeks ahead of time, and get them on the floor, get them started, get their training up to speed, and actually do some really strategic planning and strategic hiring, which makes them more successful and us too.
Thank you very much, Janice. I really appreciate your dialing in and giving us your perspective. Committee questions for any of our panelists?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. A couple of questions. Let's go back perhaps to Agnes. How do you gauge success? And I guess this applies to all the panel here. And I guess if we look at where we are as a state, looking at our unemployment rate, looking at how we fare on a relative basis, let's say with our neighbors to the north, our neighbors to the east, other states and so forth, are we accomplishing what we think we are? I mean, are we really making a difference? Or Should we perhaps engage, I guess, as we do in education all the time, you know, we talk about best practices. You know, we talk about, okay, one school district's doing something that's really hitting it out of the park achievement-wise. We want to find out what's working there and maybe adopt that and bring it over here. We do it with higher ed as well. In your efforts, and this could apply to any of you, do you actually engage in best practices on a national level, looking at what other states are doing? Obviously, there are states who are much better positioned than we are from the unemployment perspective. Are we willing to look outside and actually look at some of the institutional things that perhaps exist in those states, or things that perhaps don't are not present there that are dragging their economies, that we may have here in Oregon that are impediments to all of us, what we'd like for all of us like to see, which would be a more thriving, robust economy?
So if I may take
the question,
co-chairs. And I may ask for some help with this one. My answer would be, are we making a difference? I would say for every job seeker who does find a job through our system, I would say yes. They would all argue that if we hadn't been there, they would not be where they are. For every company that has used the system and made a hire and is pleased with that hire, I would say yes, we're making a difference. The question is whether we can look across all of these programs and determine what are our best practices for all of these various populations. I think that's a place where we need to do some improvement. I think we have a variety of program measures as opposed to a strong understanding of how those program measures play into larger system results. Although we have attempted to do some of that in the past, we definitely are looking at best practices, both internally, in terms of things that are happening in Oregon that seem to make a big difference, partnerships that seem to be flourishing and working, and what results we're getting from those. But we are also looking at what other states are doing. For our strategic plan, one of the first things that the consultants did was to look across the U.S. to find the best practice states, the ones that are consistently ranked the highest in terms of outcomes and innovation, and we're trying to learn from those. We've also engaged in the National Governors Association workshops and academies. On certain programs, we've even been the leaders. For example, Pathways, we're the ones that are often brought in to teach others how to help do that. So there are places where we definitely have shining stars. But I think part of what we're trying to do over the next 9 months, as soon as we finish the first phase of the planning process, is to dig deeper on that and to learn more and to set ourselves up so we can better analyze the information we're already getting in. We have received federal grants to do all kinds of interesting and innovative activities. The question is, do we ever bring those to scale? And how would we bring those to scale? So I do think we've got some of it. I think there's more we can do. And part of our commitment is more evidence-based, more best practice-based. This is a field where it's kind of hard sometimes to find evidence-based because it's set up so differently in every state. So sometimes it's hard to find apples-to-apples comparisons. That doesn't mean we can't learn from what others have done successfully. And that's exactly what we want to do more of. So there's room for improvement for us there.
Well, perhaps what I'm getting at may be outside of your purview of what you all are involved in, but I guess I'm just thinking about something as essential as examining the, how does the cost of doing business in Oregon compare to other states that have a much lesser unemployment rate? Mm-hmm. Would that be a different task force, or is that something that at all could be involved in what you all are investigating and in your strategic planning and so forth and so on? I'm trying to get to the base elements of the economy here. Rather than just simply talking about the folks that are in the unemployment rate, I'm trying to find about why are they in the unemployment line. That's where I'm trying to go with this
Representative
discussion.
Denver, Representative Johnson, I appreciate the insight that you bring to that one question. What we have struggled with for years is how our programs affect the big picture, the big economy picture. And we know intuitively that if we put 6,000 Oregonians to work in a particular year, that we must be making a difference in the unemployment rate. But the truth is, a rise and fall of 0.5% in the interest rate, or the amount of foreclosures that are on the market, or the something that happens in that huge economy to our south, the state of California, has a much greater effect on the unemployment rate than our frankly, little in comparison programs do. We know intuitively that it must make a difference, and we can show that we have made that progress, and we have companies that say, yes, having that person has made the difference in my company, success. But to say that it affects the unemployment rate, that's a stretch, and economists will tell you that that's very difficult. So, but I appreciate the insight, because that, as Agnes said, that's exactly what we're trying to work toward. What system measures do we have that could possibly show that we are making a difference in the big picture?
And just one more follow-up, if I could. I appreciate where you're going with that, but I guess I would take it even further and say, look at what potentially could a state income tax rate that we have, how could that influence? What about a capital gains tax? I'm looking at some of these infrastructure things. Again, as we talk about best practices and what is going on in those states that have a much different economic picture than we do here in Oregon. But one other follow-up for you, if I could, please. Greg, you mentioned, yeah, I think, on your stakeholder comment, you said you talked about partnering with various stakeholders. Do you have industry partners in that group? And if so, could you identify perhaps what advocacy groups they might be? I'm thinking about groups like AOI or someone else that represent a consortium of private sector industries.
Co-chairs, Representative Johnson, yes. We do have those partners. One of the things that, well, obviously, we have a business-led board. So, and all of them have business connections, associations, whatever, Portland Business Association, AOI, numbers of different groups. But we have also been talking very closely with the Oregon Business Council and the Oregon Business Plan. Duncan Wise has been very much, he's been consulted along the way. We are considering, and we've been having some preliminary discussions with our workforce strategic plan becoming the workforce plan of the Oregon Business Plan, for example. And a number of venues like that. And then, of course, when we have a draft plan, we expect a very wide stakeholder review. We'll be sending it to every chamber, we'll be putting it up on a link and sending that link to everyone you could possibly think of. And in fact, if anyone on this committee has ideas of stakeholders that we should include, please let me know.
Okay, thank Agnes, you. And then Rep. Sheehan had a question.
Co-chair Dembro and Co-chair Johnson, just one other point related to that is that while there are the statewide associations, a lot of this work happens on the ground in local communities. And I would say when you get to local communities, you tend to have a very strong business advocacy voice in the local workforce boards. There's a lot of industry consortia that are staffed through boards where the boards actually convene industry members when there isn't another logical convening body to sit down and talk to them and ask them more about their needs. There's cases like, for example, in Kim's case where she's actually also acting as director of a smaller economic development group, a local business alliance. So we do have workforce board directors and staff that are actually also staffing business alliances where they're being supported to try to integrate those types of activities.
Thanks. Rep. Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like we've got all of the universities, all the community colleges, all the trade organizations, all the professional technical groups, all of the chambers of commerce. We've got your organization, the governor hired you as a policy advisor. You've got WorkSource Oregon sort of on top of everything with its own strategic plan. We've got regional directors. Why do you need this?
Okay. So, Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembro.
I think your question answers itself, Rep. Sheehan. I think just by all of these different... Sorry, Agnes,
no,
you
answer. I'd love to hear you finish.
Well, just that, you know, you have all of these different entities, each of which is, you know, has its own strategic plan, doing its own thing, and, you know, there is obviously going to be a fair amount of duplication and inefficiency and misplaced priority and some partnerships that could be there that are not there. And that's what, you know, I think the goal of this legislation is, to take all of those and tie them up together and to make them work better together.
Mm-hmm. That's your answer?
So, I mean, do we absolutely need a piece of legislation for that? We may not. Are we happy to have the partnership of the legislature on this? Absolutely. I had seen this as an opportunity for us to be lined up around these pieces when Representative Denbrough and I first started talking about it. So that was where we had left.
If I could just follow up quickly, I see this as a... Well, it seems like we're already doing this, and you're already doing this, and I understand your points. I just don't think that all those tiers underneath are going to go away or take direction from the state when they have their own regional goals or their own industry-specific goals. I just see this as one more layer, one more group, and one more advisory committee that to add to an existing ton of them.
Right, and let me just clarify that the advisory committee that's mentioned in the bill is the existing Workforce Investment Board. There was a problem in the drafting, and the relating to clause spoke to an advisory committee, but the advisory committee is the Workforce Investment Board. And so what this bill is doing is it's tasking the Workforce Investment Board to really ramp up and produce within the next year give us what we believe that we need. So, yes, sir.
And that's exactly my comment, Mr. Chair, is a perfect piggyback to what you just said, because I think I would agree with Representative Sheehan. There's huge challenges. There's lots of layers, and some places where it's coordinating well. I mean, I actually think Patrick and I know Kim, and there's actually pretty good coordination with now the two organizations that she heads up. I mean, the part of the bill I like the best is actually in line 12 and 13, where it's directing them specifically to come up with legislative proposals. Not just to try and figure out the local coordination. That's a challenge in and of itself. Maybe this will help with that. Maybe it won't. But in terms of coming back and specifically saying to us, definitively, these are the places you should focus. We had in the Transportation Committee that Representative Sheehan and I serve on, we had Lowell Miles, who Kim knows well, come in last week. He owns a manufacturing company, and he's been really active in the workforce board, really active in the chamber. And, he's very much he's a very conservative Republican, that'd be fair, I'd say about Lowell. And yet he came in specifically and said, this is one specific thing that the legislature should pass. it was a related to some targeted funding for community college workforce development. And having that kind of advice, I mean, frankly, when you have community college people come in and say that, you're expecting they're going to say that because it's kind of a natural self-interested thing. But when you have a CEO, a longtime CEO of a manufacturing company, come in and say, here's the problem we're facing in our company and that I'm hearing from other companies in our area, and this is exactly what the legislature should do to fix it. That's the part that I'm most encouraged about in this bill, is that it'd be great if it encourages long-term coordination too, but even if it just accomplishes that, of bringing back some direct legislative proposals that then we can act upon to strengthen Oregon's business climate and future workforce, I think that's worth it in and of itself.
Thank you, Rep. Hunt. Okay, very quickly.
Very
please.
Quickly. Yes. So if the benefit, the main benefit of this is to bring forth legislation, then what is the role of the governor's policy advisor on workforce development?
So Co-Chair Denbrough, Co-Chair Johnson, so as I stated in my testimony, one of the challenges from where I sit is this idea that there is guarantee that a legislative answer is the fix. I don't know that at this point in time. That is one of the challenges, is that the proposals, it may be that our issue is federal. It may be that it's not a state issue. It may be that it's an interpretation of the way we do some business that could easily be done. So I can't guarantee that there is a state ask at this point, just to be perfectly clear, that I can't guarantee that there is a state ask at this point. A year from now, we'll know whether there's a state ask in this when we've actually done the groundwork and done the research and looked through all of this. But that, for me, while maybe the most appealing from a legislative perspective, was also the most challenging, because I'm just not sure whether we actually need legislation yet. we're too early in this process of looking at the alignment in terms of the implementation phase. The strategic planning phase is nearly complete, but the next 9 months really are about what it takes to get to greater alignment, what it takes to get to better results. And so, I, to be honest, I don't know that it's legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you so much for lots of good stuff that's going on, and I appreciate that, and seen pieces of that here and there, certainly in my district. And so I think that the things that are occurring are good and wise. We are talking about the Dash 1 amendments, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So when I've heard, I just heard you comment that, Agnes, about it may or may not require legislative assistance to do this. When I look at page 2 of the bill, very top sentence of the bill is Workforce Investment Board shall constitute an advisory committee that shall develop proposed legislation related to workforce development for introduction during the 2013 regular legislative session. So that says to me, you better go find a bill.
Yeah. And let me just, can I clarify that's what's going to be fixed in the Dash 2s.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Sorry.
That's huge.
Yeah.
And that's my concern. I think, you know, I'll be honest, I'm sitting here, I love this stuff, I love my community colleges, I love the workforce development piece, and I'm going to a town hall in SIO tonight to talk about flood. Mm-hmm. And first thing they're going to say is, so Sherry, what's up, what you been doing today? I don't want to say I talked about another task force, basically. Talk about how to create a better skilled workforces for jobs when everybody sitting in the room is going to say, well, I didn't have a job and now my house is flooded too. I'm struggling with that disconnect. That is nobody's fault. But as I'm sitting here, that is my huge wrestling match, is how I go in there and tell the widow who, mm-hmm, husband died less than a year ago, was working at the Covered Bridge Coffee House until it flooded, she has no job, and we're going to talk about these things when they're occurring. And they need to occur, and they are, and I'm happy that they're occurring. So there's, for what that's worth.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Rep. Springer. And, you know, I'll just say, you know, one of the things we all have to learn to do as legislators is multitask, right? We have to be concerned about what's happening right in front of us right now. We also have to look to the future. And, you know, there are, you know, there are businesses that have a need for skilled workers. There are people who are currently working but who will not be working because they don't have the skills to grow with their companies. You know, there are people who are going to be retiring, and we need to replace them with people with the high skills. So somehow we need to find a way to do both at the same time. So, panel, thank you very much for being here with us. We have one more panel that I'd like to call up now. Rosie and Janice, you're certainly welcome to keep listening if you can and would like to. But now we'd like to call up Elena Guinea, John Molis, and Brian Krieg, please, to give us a labor perspective on workforce development. What does labor have to do with workforce development? Tell me that.
Absolutely nothing, Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And, you know, when I first started at the AFL-CIO, I was actually researching apprenticeship programs and workforce and how we might be able to expand the training that goes on in our manufacturing unions. And I spent a lot of time looking at what was already in place and what wasn't and what the options were in an industry that frankly has a hard time keeping up on training. And I very quickly learned that everybody has a gripe with our workforce system. Everybody thinks they have the solution to fixing it, and nobody's working together to actually make that happen. And I think, you know, Representative Springer, Representative Sheehan, some of your questions got at why we're even bringing a bill up to do this, and my answer would be very simply that people aren't working together now. People aren't looking in a joint way at how we can streamline things, and sometimes it takes a little bit of legislative direction to make that happen. by bringing a bill forward to say do this, you can put your priorities in that bill. You can say here are the things that we really should be striving for, things like the high-wage jobs and high-skilled workers that the bill testifies to. And you can give not only the push that we need to start working together more, but also some direction for what we should be working towards. And I think that right now that's absolutely crucial. I understand that another task force is not something we want to leave this session bragging about, but sometimes that's what it takes to find out what really needs to be done. And it is high time that we all sit down and work together to find out what needs to be done. You've heard a lot about what this bill does. I don't want to get into that, but from our perspective, it's incredibly important that we do this now. We are glad to be a part of the discussion and to start thinking about how we can do more to improve workforce in the state and how we can work with our state agencies, our community colleges, and our employers in the state to do more for the people of Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is John Wallace. I represent the Oregon State Building Trades Council, and I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 4141 as amended. In my position with the building trades, I track workforce development very closely. Our labor management apprenticeship programs are one piece of this puzzle that we've been talking about this afternoon. Apprenticeship is our system of higher education. In fact, we like to call it the original four-year degree, and I know some of you have heard that before, but it's a term we take quite a bit of pride in. Others before me have spoken more eloquently about the need for more accountability and more transparency and better results, and we support all of those things, and so I will save you the pain of me reciting all those bullet points, and I'll skip by them. But it does seem to make good sense to me to take a good, honest look at the system that we have in place and figure out how we can make it work better for everyone in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Brian?
Thank you. Chair Dembrough, Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, the sheet metal air conditioning contractors, the workers of the sheet metal workers Local 16, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I'll agree with the things that were said by Alana and John before me. Better weaving the needs of business and the workforce absolutely needs to be done in this state. And this needs to be taken a look at for the long haul. We are in a down cycle at the moment, and we've focused a little bit here in some of the discussions about getting those people back to work and other things. But I can also remember sitting in, I think it was probably the same room, 6 to 8 years ago, over about a three-year cycle, with group after group coming to you looking for money to do more trainees because they were in a boom. They needed workers at many of our businesses. And they said, hey, we the kids who are coming to us or other people aren't ready, and we need help, and we don't have the money and the resources. We haven't put enough away to really be able to deal with this situation. We need your help. This is a cyclical issue, and we need to look at it, and in looking at it with a strategic plan of the nature you're talking to with this committee and everything is really important, because we need to be preparing for the good days along with the bad days. It's something that the unions and the training programs that I represent do, and it's something, though, that still affects us. And there's the other tie of this in looking down the line to how we tie this in with our restructuring of the schools. And I'm going to touch on the CTE program. We've got a bill in last session. Most of you were sponsors of it. That's an important start, and we need to be looking at those types of things of how are we going to train and bring those people into the workforce, too, in the long run. That's part of tying this all together also, because currently we've had to add 1 year to the training, an apprenticeship program, for a sheet metal worker, basically because the workers coming to us don't have the skills they used to have, and we have to go back and do too much remedial work, things that they could have gotten in high school, should have had there at that level before they came to us. With that, I'd like to close.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. Do we have anyone else here to speak on this? No. Okay, with that, then, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4141. And I will open a work session on House Bill 4141 for the purpose of adopting these amendments. As I said, we will be then seeking some amendments that will make it clear that the result of this process may be legislation, but it doesn't require it to be legislation. And also some, you know, originally the intent was that it would also refer to potential federal waivers to be sought, and other initiatives.
Mr. Chair, would we rather wait and do that when we have amendments that are more clean than these?
Well, I was thinking that we would use these as base amendments, and then, but we could do that and just have them build it off of this.
That would be better. I guess I would prefer that, to be able to look at it in its entirety when we get the amended document together.
Could do that.
I prefer that.
I did not open a work session, did I? I said I was going to.
You did. Okay.
All right, I'm going to close the work session. I'm going to carry this bill over to Tuesday, at which time we will deal with it definitively. And so I'll close the work session now on this bill. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4102, is it? 4002.
Rep. Clem coming in?
Yeah, I don't see Rep. Clem, so maybe we will ask Christina McNitt to just, or someone, to come up and present the bill. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And I'll briefly introduce this bill to you. In a nutshell, 25 words or less, this bill would create a forestry education council that would function very similar to the Engineering and Technology Industry Council that was established by the legislature in 1997. In both cases, these councils would be designed to assist the state's higher education system to ensure that the system is responsive to the future workforce needs of critical Oregon industry sectors. One case, the high-tech sector, and in this case, the forestry sector. Now, this bill directly affects the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. There's representatives from the college here that will talk with you later. The College of Forestry at Oregon State is widely seen as the top forestry school in the country. That's something I think we should all be proud of. And one of the things it does, continues to do, and is one of the few remaining colleges in the country of forestry that does this, is to train traditional forestry students through a professional forestry degree program. There's been a trend recently across the country where other very highly regarded forestry schools in recent years have kind of gotten away from that traditional function. Just regionally, very good universities on the West Coast, University of Washington, UC Berkeley, their curriculums have gotten away from that important function. So for the forest industry in Oregon, maintaining that at Oregon State University is critical to our future workforce needs. Both of you are correct that there is some thematic connection between this bill and the bill you just heard in terms of workforce investment, workforce development. So what brought us to ask you to consider this bill is the same kind of thinking, same kind of concerns that the high-tech community went through in the early 90s that resulted in the ETIC program. I think it's important to note that, like the ETIC program, House Bill 4002 creates an account into which dollars of various sources could be deposited, but we're not suggesting at this point that any money be put into the account. It would just be a vessel that would be available for future consideration. We support the College of Forestry. The forest industry supports the College of Forestry already extensively in a number of different ways. Every 2 years, you consider a bill that assesses a harvest tax on timber harvest that we support. And this last session, the portion of that tax that goes to Oregon State for forestry research primarily was $3 million a year. So that's a substantial investment that we're willing to make and willing to continue to make. in the future, we may be willing to increase that investment. The College of Forestry has some unique challenges in terms of funding that are specific to them, that has been a chronic source of frustration for us and the college in dealing with at the Oregon State University. We want to help solve that problem, and we've been in discussions with the College of Forestry about how can we strengthen the partnership, increase our financial commitment, and we may very well be willing to do that in the future. That would, if this bill passes, it will create a mechanism to have that conversation in a different way in 2013, and I think in a way that would likely be mutually beneficial to the college and to our workforce needs. So that's the basis of the bill. You have the Dash 1 amendments also. They're really not that much different from the original bill. I think he just rewrote the whole thing because there were some words that had to be put in at various places. But the main difference just between the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments is that the entity that would appoint the council is the president of Oregon State University rather than the State Board of Higher Education. And that was at Oregon State's suggestion because based on all the mega changes that are going on in higher ed these days, there may not be a State Board of Higher Education in the future. And so, unlike engineering and ETIC, where there's engineering programs both at Oregon State, Portland State, OTI, there's only one College of Forestry. So it's appropriate for the appointing authority here to be the president of the Oregon State University. There was a couple of other changes in Section 1 that were made to address issues that were brought to our attention both by Oregon State and the Treasurer's Office, and I think those are fine. So that's in a nutshell, Mr. Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ray, and thanks for bringing this forward to us. I have two quick questions. One has to do with the workforce needs that you see in forestry. Are we having a problem, with growing our own foresters and forestry engineers? And when I say growing our own, obviously our focus is on Oregonians coming up through the pipeline.
Mr. Chair, I think at the moment the OSU in particular is meeting that need. Our concern is into the future. That as this committee knows much better than I do, there's a lot of pressure on higher ed these days, financial and otherwise. And I think what's happened in some of these other colleges that can't happen here is a mindset that forestry is a dying industry, and that it's there's no reason to continue to keep that sort of a thing as part of your overall offerings at higher education. And it is not a dying industry. I mean, the forest land base is constant. There's a need for trained professional foresters to make sure those lands are properly managed. It's not just us. It's in Oregon, the state owns almost 1 million acres of forest land. The state forestry department needs to have forestry graduates that they can hire that are qualified to manage those lands, the Tillamook State Forest and others. So it's more of a concern about looking around and see what's happening in other places and making sure that this college continues its traditional function and maintains the professional degree program.
Thank you. And I just want to follow up with that notion of a pipeline. We heard some testimony a couple of weeks ago from people from ETIC talking about how they're looking more and more at making sure that there are high school kids who are going to go into engineering, and whether it's through robotics or other kinds of programs. And is there anything comparable in the forestry area, something like Future Farmers, but for future foresters?
There is, Mr. Chair, and there's a short video that, if you've got time, I think your staff was given a copy of that talks about that very program that's going on at high schools in various parts of Oregon. So hopefully, I think it's about 6 or 8 minutes if you have time. I think it would be worth seeing.
Okay, if we have time, that would be great. Okay, Rep. Johnson, you had a question?
Actually, no. Representative
Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the info. What changes, if any, are there in the level of applicants for this program in this school?
Representative Harker, I think the dean of the College of Forestry is here. He could answer that question better than I could. I think at the moment the enrollment is pretty constant or maybe growing a little bit. But he would be much more qualified than me to answer that question.
Any other questions?
Yes, just my only other question, Mr. Chair. B. Ray, I'm assuming that the graduates from this program are needed not just on state lands, but private sector, private timber owners would need to have the services of a forester, because it is science, sustainable, management of those lands is, it doesn't just happen. You have to know how to manage those forests and manage those species and so forth. And you talk about disease, interdiction, all that kind of stuff. So I can understand, don't just think about, folks walk, the little rangers driving around, like a forest ranger, actually talking about private sector and it helped for this program as well.
Absolutely, Representative Johnson. That's our primary interest in this bill, is our own, OFIC represents almost all of the private forest landowners in Oregon, and they do have significant workforce needs that need to be met into the future. So,
would there be an average age of the foresters that currently exist that you're aware of?
I'm not aware. Maybe the dean would have information on that. My sense is that it's a mix. There's a lot of very good young foresters that some of our members have hired in recent years they're very pleased with the quality of the education that they're getting at Oregon State, and that's what we're trying to make sure continues into the future.
Thank you very much, Ray, and please extend our thanks to the industry for their interest in this and their commitment to the forestry program.
Right. Thank you.
So who do we have? Okay, we have Thomas Manis. This first panel, this looks like an Oregon State panel. So just you all come up, you Oregon State people. We had the ducks a couple of days ago. I should have worn my OSU tie.
Oh well. Those are
well. You make a sacrifice.
They're not stylish.
Okay, Co-chairs Dembro and Johnson. For the record, my name is Hal Salwasser. I'm the dean of the College of Forestry and the director of the Oregon Forest Research Lab at Oregon State University. And it's a pleasure to be here today to express our support for House Bill 4002. Like all other institutions of higher education, we've suffered the budget cuts and the impact on our faculty capacity, and this bill proposes to restore much of that capacity and specifically focused on our professional forestry education programs. I'm very grateful to the industry for being willing to step forward and help bolster the strength of these programs. As Ray Wilkerson said, these are preeminent programs in the country, if not the world, and our graduates are in great demand. Until the economic recession of a few years ago, we essentially had 100% placement of our graduates, which means they either got a job in their discipline, they went into public service, or they went on to higher ed. And industry is a major employer of our graduates. So I'm joined here today by Dr. Thomas Manis, who's the department head in Forest Engineering Resources and Management. He's the well-kempt guy here to my right. Thomas administers four of the five professional forestry education degree programs, and specific questions about enrollments and all he'd be more than happy to handle. And he submitted some written testimony that details each of the degree programs that would be supported by this. I also have Dr. Scott Levengood, who's the director of the Oregon Wood Innovation Center. He has been requested to make a presentation if there's time on what's going on. Some pretty exciting stuff in wood innovation and the green building movement and a partnership with PSU and the University of Oregon. And then in our back here is department head Dr. Paul Dosher from Forest Ecosystems and Society, and our director of operations, Roger Admiral, who could answer any detailed questions about how the money will be managed. So with that, I'm more than happy to take any questions, and if you want to direct them to Dr. Manis, I'd be fine too.
Yes, well, Dr. Manis, do you have any words for us?
Well, Co-Chairs Dembro and Johnson, as Dr. Salwasser mentioned, my name is Thomas Manis. I'm the department head in charge of the professional forestry programs that Mr. Wilkinson discussed in his testimony. I think he said far better than I what the needs are for these graduates. And I strongly believe that this Forestry Education Council that would be set up by this bill would formalize and strengthen the relationship between industry. Oregon State University has a very strong relationship with industry that goes back for decades. That's been the strength of our professional program, and by formalizing that, I think would add a great benefit to our relationship and the programs that we offer.
Great. And so what can you tell us about what's going on in Wood?
Good afternoon, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Levengood. I'm the director of the Wood Innovation Center at Oregon State University, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the information about what we're doing at the university here this afternoon. My focus here for this presentation will be simply what and who are the Oregon Wood Innovation Center, what are we doing, and then mostly focus on some examples of our current activities so that you get an idea of the sorts of things we're doing to benefit the forest industry in Oregon. And then I'll wrap up with some areas of future focus. So the Wood Innovation Center has been around now about 6 years. It's a joint initiative, and the funding is from the statewide public service units, the OSU Forest Research Lab and the OSU Extension Service. And you see here the mission is, again, improving the competitiveness of the wood products industry by fostering innovation and broadly defined here, as it's defined here, products, processes, and business systems. So not just new products, but also the way those products are produced and the way companies manage their businesses and interact with their customers. So some examples here, I'll give examples in two broad categories here, what I would call the internal side of things, and that is the faculty invention. So you may be familiar with Dr. Kai Chang Lee's formaldehyde-free green adhesives that Columbia Forest Products now has in use in their mills across North America. There's also one more recent than that, and I do have a little show and tell, but I realize there may not be time for that, but we have this VTC, or densified wood, viscoelastic thermal compressed, is what that acronym stands for. But another way you could look at it here is bulletproof wood. And so Dr. Fred Kamke has been working on this. It's a way essentially of using heat and pressure at high moisture content to flatten the wood and densify it so that it becomes very stiff and strong. The smaller sandwich piece you have there increase the stiffness by over 3 times. And so one potential use for that would be bulletproof components. As Dr. Kamke said to me yesterday, it does you no good to have a bulletproof window if you don't have a bulletproof frame around the bulletproof window. So that's one potential use for that. I won't say any more about those here. I want to move into more the industry outreach side of things, which is my primary area of activities. And that these are these things that we do as a technical service and new product development activities for companies in Oregon. So the first one I'll talk about here is one we did a few years ago called the Oregon Woodland Cooperative. This is a group of small woodland owners based in the Portland metro area. They contacted us and asked for some help with exploring new market opportunities. And so we had a PhD student and two of our faculty develop them a report to give them ideas. Where might they go next? What new markets might they explore to benefit their members? And we suggested a wide variety of things here, and I have some there in the packet that you have in front of you, some of their own comments of what they said that the benefits from this have been. But one of them is the grad student that was working on the project, Lewis Leatherman. They hired him, and they said he was the one who actually contacted the New Seasons and began the firewood program, and they grossed over $35,000 in bundled wood sales, and then said he's on track to double that for 2011 by the time they gave me this information. So that's one example of a service that we're providing the industry. That is, if they come to us and look for a report on options of where they might go to explore new markets. The next one here I have is a picture of a couple of our undergraduate students that are they're in the renewable materials program, and they are working on assessing wood quality for the Greenwood Resources and Collins Companies. If you're familiar with the hybrid poplar plantations out near Boardman along I-84, these two students are working on the request of the company on a project to essentially answer the questions: what's the quality of this wood that we're producing? How does it vary between the clones that we're developing and how does it vary even within a stem, from the bottom of the stem through the mid of the, all the way up to the top. So they're doing things like the samples I have here where they're assessing its machinability to see how well the wood machines, how hard it is here, the samples I have here, and the dean is working for me today. This is kind of new. So again, but the critical questions the companies have to answer. What's this wood like? What can it be used for? And so this is a real win-win. Whenever we can have students like this answer critical questions that companies need to answer for their customers, as well as our students are getting some really valuable hands-on training outside the classroom to apply the skills and the knowledge that they're learning. The next example I have here is on new product development, and this is a project we undertook for Ninewood Inc. in Springfield. They make wood ceiling panels, similar to what you see over here up on the ceiling there. And this particular project was for a customer that requested that they produce a new panel out of eucalyptus, and they stipulated that the wood will not change color when it goes to a hot, wet environment like where it was being shipped. And so they came to us and asked us the question, how do we verify for our customers that that's going to be the case? And so again, working with one of our student workers, we set up a special photo booth. We took pictures. We cycled these panels through different temperature humidity regimes and then captured an image of them every week. And we're able to tell the company at the end that, sure enough, in hot, wet conditions, you do see a little subtle change that you probably can't see here on the screen, but with the color match card we have there, we were able to tell them, and they were able to relay to their customer that yes, there will be some slight change, but for this company, this was key for them to be able to talk to their customers and be able to say that they had done their homework, and we're actually doing the research through a third party to answer the questions and not just saying, trust me, it'll be fine, you know. So like they say, they're applying the science that we can provide for them in order to answer their customers' questions. The last example I'll give here is related to product performance, and this is on cracking of furniture and cabinet panels, what we call veneer checking, and it'd be the hardwood plywood like you see here on this, the podium over here, and probably in front of you on the tabletop there. This is a crucial problem facing the Oregon's hardwood plywood industry and the hardwood plywood industry in general, that in service, as the wood dries out, the surface veneers crack and they expose these white lines that the bottom line is that the customers claim it on the supplier and ship it back to them, and many times that this is a very expensive replacement because it's a piece of hardwood plywood that's gone into making the furniture like you have in front of you, so the company is expected to go in and remove and replace and repair or whatever it takes, and it's much more expensive, of course, than a finished product. And you see here a quote from Senator Wyden that approximately 70% of North America's hardwood plywood is manufactured by companies here in Oregon. And so this is a critical question, not just to the industry, but for here in Oregon in general. So here to show you here kind of the approach that we're taking here, this is a master student project that is working on this, and what you're looking at here on the left, that image is a magnification of the edge of a piece of plywood about 200 times. You may just barely be able to see this surface crack here on the top of the veneer. However, when we expose it to hot, dry conditions, it opens up like a canyon. Again, that's magnified 200 times, so it's not so dramatic. You couldn't fit a dime in there, even maybe a piece of paper, but it's very dramatic on the piece of furniture, and so this would be a very expensive claim against a hardwood plywood manufacturer. So at the least here, we've been able to demonstrate, yes, we can replicate this problem in the lab. Now what do we do about it? So Mike Bernard, a graduate student, is working on this problem right now, and he's using a technique called digital image correlation, where he's using video cameras to monitor the cracks as they happen in real time. So he exposes them to a dry climate, takes video images of them, and then is able to stop the image and calculate exactly when the cracks appear and how frequently they appear. And so he is my student, actually, and he is suffering through about 1,500 test panels that this method allows him to do. But he's going to be able, at the end here, be able to tell the hardwood plywood industry what combination of process variables and the way they make plywood will minimize this problem and reduce the costs. So I'll wrap up here with our future efforts here. We are hopeful to hire an undergraduate student research project coordinator. So this would be somebody who's helping me out and helping the other faculty and working with industry and coordinating the student researchers to do these projects, we're pretty well maxed out now on the amount of students we can get working on these. About half of our undergraduates right now are working on projects for industry like I've described here, but we could employ them all if we had somebody who was mentoring them and helping coordinate the contacts from industry. And lastly here, as Dr. Sauwasser mentioned, that the Governor Kitzhaber, both in his address to the Board of Forestry in November as well as at the Oregon Business Plan Summit here a couple of months ago, discussed options for developing a Wood Innovation Signature Research Center in collaboration with architecture and allied arts faculty at U of O and the Oregon Sustainability Center at Portland State. And so we're just in the early stages of those discussions right now and what that might look like. I've met with faculty at U of O and PSU and have talked with them about what we might focus on. And the architecture faculty in particular mentioned that they thought there were some real opportunities here to emphasize energy. So reduced energy use in our harvesting operations for the forest, or transportation of logs and finished products and residues for biomass, reduced energy consumption in building materials, as well as reduced energy use in structures, bio-based energy development, all sorts of things that could be, again, very early stages of discussion on this, but these are some of the thoughts we have, and I'm glad to take any questions you have now. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I have a question for you, and then I want to call up Rep. Clem, since he's in the room. Actually, you know, you talked about energy at the end, and that was a question I was going to ask you. I went on a tour. Was it last year that we went to Frere's Lumber.
Yeah, Alliance. It was 2 years ago.
Yeah, and they're using wood to generate energy for their mill work there, and you know, I assume that kind of thing is going to be, you know, become more common. And it's going to require engineers and workers, you know, to design those systems and to work in those systems. And I wonder, is that something that the forestry school is going to be looking at in terms of training students? I mean, not just the research, but actually training the workers for those tasks?
That degree of engineering is more likely to come from the College of Engineering,
okay.
Mechanical engineering. We educate the people that do the engineering out in the woods and handle the transportation and then the engineering of making the products. But when you get into running a boiler, that's somebody else's business.
Different deal. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the report, and obviously this broadens the definition of what the College of Forestry is about. It's not simply just growing fir trees and spruce and that kind of stuff, but the innovation of even into the softwoods, you know, with poplar and so forth. What can we do to maximize what we're growing, find new uses for that? As a builder, you know, I've witnessed the evolution of engineering. Wood products that were never there when I first started, you know, building homes and so forth, you know, from LVLs to TGIs and, you know, all those kind of, you know, products that are much better products than, in a lot of circumstances, than nature can make herself, because they don't twist, they don't crack, they're perfectly true, and it makes your job, makes you look like you're maybe a better builder than you really are. But anyway, I appreciate what you're doing, and there certainly is a need for continued innovation in this field. So I just I thank you for what you're doing and the job skills and the workforce development that you are doing by creating a whole new sector of wood product innovators who will take those skills out there and who knows what they'll be bringing back in terms of their careers.
Co-chairs Denbro and Johnson, the wood science people are working on an engineered panel that will now let you build a 10-story structure out of wood products, and it will be sound engineering and seismically.
That might create issues, but I love it.
Sounds exciting to me.
Yeah.
Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. I will repeat that question of how the applicant pool looks. But before you answer that, I just wanted to say that I love anything that's innovative with wood that keeps us from exporting logs. Okay, I don't want to become anyone's colony in that regard, and exporting resources unrefined is what colonies do. And lastly, before you answer the question, if you've seen me smiling up here, do not interpret that as the high-tech guy from Beaverton who's smirking at wood. I'm smirking at the things we learn in our lives and then forget. I used to be, after coming out of the Natural Resources School in Ann Arbor, I used to be able to identify a matchstick-sized piece of wood from any of the woods in the upper Midwest down to the species level, and I couldn't do it to save my life now. So how about those applicants?
Co-Chairs Jimbro and Johnson, Representative Harker, our enrollment picture has actually been quite bright over the last few years. We've seen increasing enrollment in all of our programs. We now have about 300 students in our undergraduate programs and in the professional programs that we're talking about here. There are four programs. Force Engineering program is really unique in the world. It's always been a very strong program here at Oregon State, but as Mr. Wilkinson mentioned earlier, programs have dropped their professional forestry education in neighboring states. The Force Engineering program has really become the program where companies, and principally ones in Oregon, go to hire engineers to ensure safety, production, and environmental protection. And we also have a forest operations management program that's business-oriented, a forest management program that's a traditional forestry program that goes back for 100 years, and the renewable materials program that's related to students that Scott was talking about earlier. So we're seeing increases in enrollment every year. Last year we graduated 60 students, and the employment picture was actually very good for them. So the demand is there, and as was mentioned earlier, with the demographics in the current industry, there will be huge need for additional professionals, and particularly in the management ranks. So it's becoming increasingly important, the knowledge that the students gain in our program. And you mentioned high tech. Before coming to Oregon State and before being an academic, I worked for a Weyerhaeuser company in technology development. And I can assure you that the wood products industry is the highest technology that you'll find anywhere. Plastic and steel, that's easy to work with. They're very consistent. Wood is not consistent. And so the computer imagery that we have to use and the computer optimization is second to none in any manufacturing industry. And these are skills and knowledge that we bring to the students at Oregon State University. And that's why we really need to focus on having a highly skilled faculty base that's there, small class sizes, and the ability to really work with students. It's a very different kind of education program than you will see in some of the more generic engineering programs that have, you know, a regular education set. And that's why we really appreciate that relationship with industry and their strong interest in building a relationship with us and funding our programs, to be quite honest. That's it. Wouldn't be possible otherwise.
Thank you. Rep. Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a very quick plug, Sio High School is one of those schools that has a forestry club, and they do some phenomenal things. It's amazing. But Scott, on your second slide here, you talked about it being a joint initiative with the OSU Forest Research Laboratory and then the Extension Service, OSU Extension Service. And I think probably it's pretty easy to see the partnership with the campus and the research laboratory and that piece of it. But talk a little bit and explain a little bit the value of extension in that also.
Thank you, Representative Springer. My position with OSU started in 1994, and I was a county-based extension faculty member in Klamath Falls, and then I was based in the Washington County Extension office in Beaverton. So I've been with Extension Service for now almost 18 years. All of our focus is on outreach, and so that's what the Extension Service component brings, is that without the industry interaction and without the industry focus and our connection to them, we don't have these projects to do. And so it's really been beneficial to me. I came to campus about 6 years ago, and it's been a fantastic way to take what I did in extension, working in the county offices, helping, going into the mills and helping them solve problems. Now I have the resources of the other faculty immediately at my disposal, as well as all the research labs there to answer questions, which more often than not, every question we get in brings in three or four other faculty area of expertise. So So it's really a great connection between the research and the outreach to solve problems and develop new products and yeah, train up our students as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm going to call up Representative Clem right now because obviously there are all these positive feelings about this bill, but it's his bill, and so we'll see if we keep feeling positive about it when he comes up to speak.
I seriously considered leaving. I thought maybe it
would be
better.
Oh, yeah, I will.
Positive beaver vibes, aren't they?
Yeah, he's not wearing the tie. I don't know.
Oh. Thank you, co-chairs. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from here in Salem, District 21, and this is one of my personal bills. When they asked me about a referral, they said, would you want it to come over to you and Escoval's committee or the higher ed committee? And I looked at the membership and I'm like, no, it can go there. It's fine. This is wonderful. So I'm glad to be here. Glad you've got possession of the bill. You know, obviously, you've heard a lot already, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. From my perspective, I think it is important that we remember that the forest products industry isn't just a huge part of our past, but is part of our future. And as engineering is a huge part of our future, forestry also needs all those same kinds of attention. So when folks came to me and said, we would like to do something similar, where we are ensuring the quality of students that are being put out over time in forestry education, and we're worried that as you all have to find challenges to difficult budgets, we may need some, you know, we may need to chip in some more. We want to make sure that these things are coordinated and done well. It's been done in some of our large employers in the tech sector already, and I thought, what a great message to send to the rest of the world that Oregon, this is our future as well, that it's still a big part of our economy. I think with some federal forest policy reforms, it could be a much bigger part of our economy, and making sure we have good educated foresters to help work with the volume that we hope to see continue to grow out of Oregon and manage in a sustainable fashion and help bring back rural Oregon. And, you know, Oregon State, obviously, I have a massive bias, but I'm pleased that they're here, and I want to make sure that that school of forestry is always in good shape. It's a very important part of that institution, and in, as I obviously said, an important part of our state's future. So that's it, and I've got a committee at 5 dealing with lots of angry people here to talk about wolves. Two of your members here may or may not come back to. They're what good souls. So I won't take any more time.
Thank you very much, Representative.
And just for the record, I'm sure Rep. Clem will agree that there's a bill in our Ag Committee that if we pass that bill pertaining to state forest lands and forests, we could actually create a lot more job opportunities for the graduates of the College of Forestry.
We'll be doing that Tuesday, I'm quite confident.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Rep. Sheehan.
I just have a quick question for Representative Clem. I have a pretty controversial bill, and I noticed the relating clause in here is pretty close. Would you mind if I just dump that in there?
Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Sheehan. If you want to include the Wood First bill in here, I would be more than happy to run with that. And now I've just given hives to two other committee members who don't ever want to discuss this again. Well, no, there's one. I gave you for getting out of
blowing up all over the building again.
Thank you, Rep. Clem.
That's okay.
Okay. We have very quickly, we have one more panel. Rex Storm from Associated Oregon Loggers. And Bill, do you want to come in and come up and say anything? Thank you.
Co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the committee, I am Rex Storm. I'm a forest policy manager with Associated Oregon Loggers based in Salem, and we represent nearly 1,000 member companies working in forest contract services, which includes more than just logging. It's forest management contracting to manage the forest. I'm also interested in this bill as a certified forester and as a tree farm owner. I'm here today to support House Bill 4002-1, and we urge you to pass this bill. Associated Oregon Loggers supports this bill because it would create a forestry education council and fund that fosters increased and carefully directed financial commitment to forestry education in Oregon. It would also do this by adding improved cooperation between Oregon State University and the private forest sector. To keep the private forest sector competitive in Oregon, we need to assure that the College of Forestry continues being a leader as one of the few schools in America, as you've already heard, that provides professional education for foresters, forest engineers, forest scientists, and wood product specialists. The reason we support this bill are four reasons, and you have a written copy of that in front of you. But let me emphasize that the first reason, educating young forest professionals is becoming increasingly important for us in the future to replace the infrastructure capacity loss, the workforce capacity that's been lost in recent years due to the recession, due to declining federal forestry, and due to escalating retirement of baby boomer generation folks. This bill would bolster cooperative investment in educating the next generation of forest sector employees. Second, Oregon forests have the sustainable growing capacity to yield 1.5 to 2 times the current timber harvest. Industry experts project that in the future, Oregon's forest harvest and manufacturing will demand a larger forest sector workforce. And this bill would assist in educating the additional professionals needed to lead this economic growth. Thirdly, we are concerned that the core forest education functions of the College of Forestry are at risk because of the increasingly strained general fund in higher education budgets. This bill, we believe, would improve the effectiveness of the dollars spent in forestry education, and it would also leverage increased private contributions into forestry education. Fourth, and lastly, the forest sector needs assurance that the private investments at the OSU College of Forestry will meet the sector's future workforce needs. The bill would provide an effective vehicle to foster expanded investment targeted towards those specific disciplines and specialties necessary to assure that Oregon's forest sector remains America's top structural wood grower and producer. So in closing, we do support 4002, and we encourage your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rex. Brother Cluding.
Thank you, Co-Chair Denver Johnson, Vice Chair's Committee. For the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters and Joiners. I see jobs. One day I hope to see a forest management plan that we can work with. We need Just think back. It wasn't too many years ago we made our first sheet of plywood. We'll always need two-bys. We made plywood. But just look what these folks have showed you, what's happened just the last few years. Some states got coal. Once they dig it, you got a hole. You remember that tree we cut? It came back. People's got oil. When they're done, they got a hole in the ground. Gas, the same way. We still got that tree growing. I admit my labor force is down. Since 85, this is 5,000 short of what we've lost as far as mill workers in this state. But these young people coming up under this program, designing stuff that we don't even know about right now, this is a vehicle. I appreciate Representative Clem bringing this forward. If there's one bill comes out this session, this is the one we need for the forest industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you both, gentlemen. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4002. And since I heard nothing but positive words about this bill, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4002.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 4002, dated 2-8-12.
Representative Johnson has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 8, 2012. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, the Dash 1s are approved.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt House Bill 4002 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill will be then, I think, will be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Co-Chair Johnson moves House Bill 4002 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there, would anyone like to make a comment about that or any discussion in general? Rep. Parker?
It's zero fiscal, I believe.
No.
We're not putting money into an account. Why is it going to Ways and Means?
It says indeterminate. That's even worse.
Legislative fiscal has determined this fiscal is indeterminate at this point. But, you know, I mean, I just will make an editorial comment once it's down in Ways and Means. And comes before the subcommittee, you know, I'm sure that we will take a very much closer look at that. Rep. Greenlee?
That's not what I started the comment on, but this is one more example of the craziness of sending policy bills to Ways and Means that don't have a fiscal. It's just, it's out of hand in this session. I hope we learn something from it. I just wanted to say that I'm really happy to vote for forestry bill. I think that the future of the state really does depend on a healthy forest industry, and I think having a strong school in Corvallis, which leads the way, I think is very exciting, and I think it's a good bill, and I'm really happy that it came to this committee.
Thank you, Representative. Subco-Chair Springer.
Thank you, I think, Mr. Chair. First of all, yeah, everybody loves this bill. What is not to love? That said, you have my assurance, being one of the sub-co-chairs of one of the co-chairs of the sub-education sub in Ways and Means. We struggle every time we gavel in to say that. I will do my best. I don't anticipate lots of struggles, but I'll do my best to make sure this moves through. This is a tremendous, tremendously good bill that has some practical implications that people will realize right away.
Thank you. Getting the Ways and Means Committee, the Ways and Means Subcommittees to have access to the bills that are before them is a struggle. And it's not dependent on the individual bills. It's the Ways and Means Committees are so busy with things, it's very hard to get them freed up to go to the subcommittees. Ridiculous.
Rep. Hunt, did you have anything to say? Okay, thank you. I would just echo Representative Greenlick's comments and actually everyone's comments in support of this bill. We've had some great times in this committee. I'm thinking about that metals initiative that we heard about, and some of the ETIC presentations
very
and the
similar.
STEM. There are exciting things happening in this state, and real opportunities for our young people if we can only nurture them. And so with that, I would be happy to call the roll.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Lindsey?
He's excused.
Representative
Sheehan?
Yes.
Co-Vice Chair Greenlee?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes.
Co-Chair Deborah?
Yes. And with that, the House Bill 4002 passes. I want to just quickly open a work session on House Bill 4057 for the purpose of approving a dash four amendments.
You just want to carry it over.
I was going to adopt the amendments. These people are here to speak to them. They do something that OUS needs and make a change for the community colleges. Or we could wait till Tuesday to do that.
I prefer to wait.
Yes,
I feel bad about having you sat here the whole time.
Well, why don't you ask him to speak?
He can get a speaking on the record if he'd like to do that. That'd be fine.
Okay, so did I gavel?
You're in.
Okay. Open the work session on House Bill 4057. John, you want to come up with our good friend Jack Esselman? Thank you.
Uh-oh.
So just quickly, the Dash 4 amendments allow us to solve a problem that we have with Senate Bill 242 that passed last session. It's not a problem, but it allows to create a more workable time frame for a process that bill mandates. And it also eliminates a line on page 2, line 9, the pay differential for the faculty categories. And what that's about is we have added the line below it about the average contracted wages for each employee group. Now, rather than just look at faculty, of course, with this bill, we're looking at all the employee groups. We have found a simpler way to do it, and this is a way that the community colleges would prefer that we do it.
Chair Denver, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. I'll be brief since you've had a long hearing at the end of what I'm sure is a long day. Should you move forward with House Bill 4057, we would support adopting the Dash 4 amendments because, as Representative Denver said, they would make collecting data on pay simpler, and it would be easier for the colleges to make sort of an apples-to-apples comparison for the legislative body. And so should this concept move forward, we think this would simplify and make more practical collecting pay data from the colleges. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And it simplifies the process that you're required to do now, the various changes in this bill, correct?
Chair Denbro, yes. Under the current process, the colleges are experiencing some difficulty trying to match differing definitions for things like full-time FDE and what the definition of a part-time FDE is at different colleges. And this and in these amendments, that process is made simpler.
So it should be easier for the colleges to comply then.
Yeah. For that part of it, that would be it would make that process simpler than it currently is under statute.
Okay, thank you, John. Any questions for Mr. Wyckoff? Mr. Isselman.
Chair Denbro, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Isselman appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon University System. We have a small amendment that we are bringing forward to the bill. We're taking advantage of the bill's relating clause. In Senate Bill 242, which was passed last session, thank you all for your support on that bill, we established two labor management committees, one to look at benefits, health care benefits, one to look at retirement benefits. I'm pleased to report those labor management committees have been constituted and have begun their work. It occurred to us, kind of on the front end of this work, that several members of those labor management committees would not be available to meet in the summer months because of their employment contracts. So we're requesting a two-month extension. There was an October due date in the bill for the report of this committee. We would bring the report in December, and that's the amendment that's before you in the bill. Otherwise, we would be subject to the reporting requirements in the bill, but we're not. Those changes aren't subject to this amendment. So. That's it. Thanks.
Any questions for Jack?
You're basically in quest for a relating clause, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Great. Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Committee, if it's okay, I would like to adopt these amendments now and then carry the bill forward until Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, okay. I'd prefer to do that on Tuesday.
Is there a reason?
Well, if we're ultimately not going to move the bill, I'm not convinced there's a need to adopt the amendments. That would be my point, I guess. You and I can certainly have that conversation.
Want to stand at ease and deal
with
this?
Yeah, could we just stand at ease for a moment? Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt or amend the dash fours into House Bill 4057, which is already amended with the dash twos. Is that
correct? That's not even
not correct.
Here, this
really?
Is what you
You're actually, this is correct?
Yes, this is correct.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move reconsider the vote by which the dash two amendments dated, which we don't even yet. Is that the correction?
That isn't what he said. He said you don't need to do that.
Yeah, Charlie said we didn't need to do that.
Yeah, I don't think you need
he
to.
Think we can just take the dash fours it's on top.
There's no conflict, really. It's
okay,
just
so
this
we're
is just addition.
That was our LC opinion here. Yeah. So.
Alrighty.
So I would go back to my original motion, Mr. Chair. I move we just adopt the dash four amendments into the House Bill 4057 as amended.
Okay, Chair Johnson has moved the dash four amendments of House Bill 4057 as amended.
And so list the date of the amendment.
Yeah, the amendment is February 9th, 2012. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, the amendments are adopted. Okay, I'm going to close this hearing. Going to carry over House. Thank you. Going to carry over House Bill 2057 to Tuesday's
40,
hearing. 4057 until Tuesday's hearing, and I will close this hearing of the House Committee on Higher Education. Thank you all for your patience.